voice in Spain.
From the Sky News Centre at midday, the parents of terminally ill baby Charlie Gard are renewing their campaign, calling on doctors to allow him to travel to the US and receive experimental treatment. A petition with over 350,000 signatures will be handed to staff at Great Ormond Street Hospital today. It comes ahead of a fresh hearing at the High Court tomorrow over the case. Justice Secretary David Lidington MP says he feels for Charlie's parents and the judges involved.
Frankly, I do not envy the judges who are having to take decisions on this. It must be an incredibly pressured, probably emotional, you know, underneath the judicial professionalism, a really emotional, sort of heart-wrenching case for them to have to decide.
The government has called the scale of contraband in prisons unacceptable after 225 kilograms of drugs were confiscated in England and Wales last year. Figures also show 13,000 mobile phones were recovered and 7,000 SIM cards. Prisons Minister Sam Gyimah says they're facing new challenges.
These new psychoactive substances are a game changer in our prisons. The new mobile phones we are seeing are phones that are the size of a car key phone fob, specifically designed to be smuggled in as contraband and to avoid detection.
Parents are being warned about an online game that encourages players to take their own life. There have been at least 130 suicides around the world after people played the Blue Whale game. Six opposition party leaders are calling for a Hillsborough-style inquiry into a contaminated blood scandal. During the 1970s and 80s, haemophiliacs and others were infected with hepatitis C and HIV from blood products. In sport, England's cricketers have lost two early wickets on day four of the first test against South Africa. A short time ago, England were 142 for 3 in their second innings, 239 runs ahead. And Britain's Lewis Hamilton will start the Austrian F1 Grand Prix back in eighth when the race begins in an hour's time. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Talk Radio Europe. We are your voice in Spain.
Calanova Golf Club, situated in the renowned Valley of Golf and one of the most distinguished golf clubs on the Costa del Sol. Come and check out the improvements and updates we have made. Visit the new clubhouse, practice facilities and our wonderful pro shop. If you need help to improve your golf, then why not book a lesson at the Michael Campbell Golf Academy? Calanova Golf Club, located in La Cala de Mijas, is the perfect location in which to play a round of golf with stunning views of the Mediterranean. Enjoy our summer discounts by booking online at lacalanova.es.
This is Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Life Stories. With Ian Rutter.
Hello and welcome to this week's Life Stories with me, Ian Rutter. Today I'm in my own part of Spain, the beautiful Valle de la Crin, a hidden corner full of orange, olive and almond trees, and between Granada, the Sierra Nevada and the coast. My guest is Ron Potter, a chap well known in these parts, as he lives in the village of Melahis, is married to a Spaniard and runs an estate agency, property rental and management business, and an intensive English language school. Hello Ron, and thanks very much for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
Ron, you've had a pretty varied life, and I've mentioned the businesses that you now have here in Spain, but perhaps you can give me a few more details. What is it you do here?
Initially, we started as a property management company and an estate agency. The idea was to build the business up and sell it on, but then there was the crisis, and we decided we needed more strings to our bow, so I'd noticed a long time ago that there's a definite lack of conversational English in Spain, so we opened a school which concentrates purely on language speaking.
And have you had any experience of teaching before?
Yes. So I've been an instructor for years, and then I took a TEFL course, and I was working in Portsmouth in England for 5 years in a language school there.
Okay, and the concept behind the school, tell me a bit more about that. You say sort of intensive English. How does the school operate?
Well, I identified when I first came down here that the Spaniards have a head full of grammar and they can read English very well, but they just don't speak it and they don't have a chance. If they go to an academy, there'll be 30 people in the class, sometimes 40 people in a class, so they really don't have the opportunity to speak. Having identified that opening, we decided that we'd open a school which would purely concentrate on conversational English with no more than 6 adults in the class, 8 adolescents. And we do a lot of one-to-one, a lot of specialist stuff, depending on who wants to do what. I mean, we are here as a business, and whatever people want, we will do that.
You're as a business, but you're actually in a very remote part of Andalusia that's off the beaten track. Not many people know about the Valle de Alhucin. Where do your pupils come from, generally?
Generally, they come from Granada City, but we've made contacts with various multinationals in Granada City, and we've had people come from Germany, people come from Paris, people come from the Basque Country, all over Spain now. I have a military background, and the word got out, so we also have quite a lot of students from the military academies in Zaragoza and A Coruña, because now all officers in the military or the Guardia Civil must have English to a quite a high level. So we have a number of students come down from there.
And how have you got word out? Is it word of mouth, or have you done a marketing campaign? How have you publicised the school?
We've been on the radio a lot. We've been on television. We've been in the newspapers. Because it's something unique, there are other companies that offer this sort of thing, but not as intimately as we do. And because we're unique, as I say, the word has got around, and a lot of the stuff now is word of mouth. We're just starting our courses now for the summer, the intensive courses for the adolescents, and at least a third of them are repetidores. Repeat students.
Repeat students, yeah. And you mentioned the estate agency and the property rental business, which was obviously affected by the crisis. How long has that been under your aegis, if you like? So when did you take that business over?
We took it over in September 2004, and everything was marvellous, actually, until a couple of years after the crisis, and then it just died a horrible death. Not just for our business, but for everybody else. We are a bit unique here and off the beaten track, so the estate agencies down on the coast have more of a job of it, or a better job of it than we do. But that now has sort of moved into second place to the language school. The property maintenance, we still have the majority of the clients we had when we started, because they still have their houses here, and they still need us to look after them. But after how long we'll be going now, 13 years, we've got all the systems in place, and if anyone wants anything, we can supply it, be it builders or plumbers or anything, really.
And is the business improving now?
It was until the Brexit, and after the Brexit, in fact, we did very well. I sold a lot of houses within 2 months. And then people realised they didn't know what was going to happen with the Brexit. Then Article 50 was triggered, and then had the general election. So really, that side of the business, the sales, is on a back burner at the moment. Mainly because our clientele are from the UK. Other people, of course, you know, if you have a company that's working with Scandinavia, then it doesn't affect them so much.
Now, Ron, I ask all of my guests to choose 6 pieces of music that best represent periods in their life, music that evokes a strong memory or marks a significant moment in your life. What would your first piece be, and why have you chosen this particular piece?
It's something that always cheers me up and gets me kicked into gear. It's Handel's Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. And I'm very keen on jazz, traditional jazz, and this sort of music where you've got the whole orchestra playing together, it just turns me on and it really lifts me up. If I'm feeling down, I'll play this and that'll get me going for the day.
Live Stories this week, my guest is Ron Potter, former military man and now the owner of a handful of businesses in the beautiful Lecrin Valley between Granada and the Costa Tropical. Now, Ron, we mentioned in the first part the businesses that you run now. Your very early career was spent in the army. How did you get involved in the army?
I jumped from grammar school before I was pushed. I had the gypsy's warning from the headmaster. I happened to be walking past the recruiting office in Dartford in Kent. And I walked in and they offered me the earth. And I joined at 15 as a junior leader, which is to train us to be the leaders of the future, the warrant officers and the sergeants in the British Army.
Was the army always something that you had a hankering for, or was this just an opportune moment?
I never thought about it before.
I never thought about it afterwards.
No, I just saw this, and I didn't belong to the cadet corps in the school. I just saw it, and I don't know.
And you were quite young. I mean, this was you were age 15 when
15, yeah. I don't think you can do it nowadays, but in those days, we were joined as junior leaders.
And was it a baptism of fire? Was it what you expected it to be?
Nope.
Or did it just keep you off the streets?
No, it certainly wasn't a baptism of fire. It was a bit like a public school. The same sort of rules applied. There was, if you like, fagging and that sort of stuff. There was quite a lot of bullying. But no, it was bearable.
Where were you trained? Where was training?
I did my training. I joined the Junior Leaders Royal Artillery, and their base was in Bramcote, just outside Nuneaton, in Warwickshire. So I did 2.5 years there. Went at 15. Grew 7 inches in 2 years. And then after your training there, when you get to 17 and a half, they let you loose in the real army.
Were your first postings in the real army within the United Kingdom, or did you start getting overseas postings almost straight away?
Because we were junior leaders, we were all very fit, and we had quite a lot of military skills and trades by the time we left after 2.5 years. And the most kudos was to be gained from going to the parachute regiments or the commando regiments, the army commando regiments. And at the time, the parachute regiment was based in Aldershot, and it only ever went abroad, really, to go to Aden and places like that. Whereas the commando regiment did 2 years in Singapore. There were two regiments, in fact. They took turn and turn about 2 years in Singapore. So I thought, well, a couple of years in Singapore will suit me very nicely. Mm-hmm. So I did the commando training, the Marine commando training. And then I spent a year in Plymouth and then went out to Singapore at 18 and a half.
And you were married at this stage, were you?
Yes, I was married. My wife was 3 months pregnant. But in those days, it wasn't permitted for soldiers. It wasn't recognised that you were married if you were a soldier, if you were younger than 21, and for officers it was 25. So as far as the army concerned, I wasn't married. I couldn't take my wife with me. I didn't get paid any extra. I just got paid as a single private soldier. And as far as the army's concerned, my family didn't exist.
And how long were these postings for? I mean, how often did you get back?
I didn't get back.
So you were stuck there for the duration of your posting in Singapore?
Yeah, I was supposed to be there for 2.5 years. Then after just over a year, year and a quarter, they changed the law to say that you could bring families over. So my family, no, it's longer than that probably a year and a half. By which time my daughter was 8 months old. The first time I saw her, she was 8 months old. And again, in those days, there were no telephone calls. There were just what we call the blueies, the free military envelopes you got to write. So that was it. Well, I left when she was 3 months pregnant and saw my daughter when she was 8 months old for the first time.
That must have been pretty tough for someone who's, I mean, relatively young.
Yes, it is tough, yeah. I wasn't the only one. There were others. And the army sort of did give me a little bit of leeway. If I did kick over the traces now and again, they said, well, you know, he is probably suffering a little bit. No, I think we all developed an ability to switch off, which I think is an ability you learn in the forces anyway.
And, I mean, did things improve when your family was able to come and join you, or was that hard for them to adjust as well?
No, it was because we had a marriage allowance, we suddenly almost tripled our wages. She had a Well, we had a nice private house down in one of the estates close to the camp, civilian estate, so it was all very nice. Didn't make any difference to me. I was still away for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks of the month, but but at least I came home to a wife and child instead of just to a barrack block.
Yeah, and a long-distance relationship with your family.
Yeah.
What's your second piece of music, Ron, and why did you choose this piece?
My second piece is... Ah, yes, The Beatles, While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Yeah, I was a teenager in the 60s, and, if you like, I grew up with the Rolling Stones and The Beatles. And for some reason, I've always been very attracted to electric guitar, and this song, it's always been there with me, I don't know why. There was a fantastic rendering the other day from, well, not the other day, but for George Harrison's memorial concert, because George Harrison wrote it, when they had Clapton playing and a few others, and it's just a very, very nice song, I think.
TRE. Talk Radio Europe. TRE.
We let our programmes do the talking.
Life Stories with Ian Rutter.
You're listening to Live Stories, and my guest this week is Ron Potter, now something of an institution in the Valle de la Crin, where he lives and works. This idyllic spot lies between Granada and the coast, and just to the east lies the Sierra Nevada and the Alpujarras. Now, Ron, just before the Beatles, we were talking about your life in the army and your early years in the army. You then spent, from Singapore, you spent 7 years travelling the world. Where did you go?
Well, in the commando force, of course, we had commando carriers. We had two types. There was those which have landing craft and those which have helicopters. So we could go anywhere. We did the Mediterranean everywhere from Cyprus through to Gibraltar. We went across to America. We did all around the British coast, just generally anywhere.
And you joined the intelligence service eventually, didn't you?
Yeah. The problem in the commandos is that the commando forces or the commando artillery regiments are chosen from the whole of the artillery. So you, without sounding big-headed, you've got the best soldiers all in one place, and promotion was terrible. So after 7 years, I had one stripe, and I hadn't seen with the wife again. I was away for about 5.5 years out of the first 7 years, and I had another daughter by then. Similar sort of thing. I was left her when she was 3 months pregnant. I saw the baby for 3 weeks when it was a month old. We were in Malta then, and Mintoff kicked off, so all the wives were sent home for another 3 or 4 months, and then we went off to America. So I thought, well, it's really about time I did the right thing by the family. So we have what we call defence council instructions, which just offer various things around the place. And I saw a defence council instruction asking for volunteers to join the intelligence corps, so I volunteered.
I mean, what was it like? I'm interested to know, because you joined the army when you were 15, to all intents and purposes, now one would consider the period from 15 to probably 28 as being your growing up time. What was it like growing up in the army?
You grow up very quickly. You're given a lot of responsibility, and you're not given much leeway. And you're certainly not given any sympathy. I think when I first joined the commandos, for instance, there were 10 of us in a room with a small cabin in the corner. And our bombardier there, he was an ex-England boxer. I think he'd done fairground boxing as well. So these were men who'd probably joined in national service and then carried on. I joined the commandos in 67, national service finished in 61. So these people have done national service and then signed on for 9 years. So there were some hard men there. And it made you grow up, because they wouldn't take any nonsense. They didn't want kids hanging around them.
You know? And do you feel in your time there that you became a hardened military man? Did it become inured? I mean, did it become part of your psyche? Or was this something you enjoyed, this life?
I don't think it became inured. I don't think anyone who knew me in my military service would ever say I was a military man. But I could do it. I've been trained to do it. I don't think it ever took me over like it does some people.
Yeah, because some, particularly the army, becomes so deeply ingrained that you never really escape it.
No, well, it's slightly different. In the commandos, you weren't really told what to do, or you were given a very broad brush outline, and you were expected to look after yourself, to be where you're supposed to be at the right time. Nobody shouted at you. If you weren't there, then, you know, you had a good chance of getting thrown out to go back to a normal regiment. And in the intelligence corps, well, they're all intelligence people. And it was slightly different, because in the intelligence corps you move one at a time. You don't move as a unit. So you'll have a unit. For instance, I spent most of my time in Cyprus. The unit would be in Cyprus, and people would move as single entities, if you like.
Mm. And when did you decide to leave the army?
I didn't really decide. When you're 40, they retire you. You can get commissioned if you go on a commission, but I wasn't offered, I don't think. Well, I was, but that's another story. And after 25 years, or 24 years, 255 days, I thought, well, no, that's enough.
But that's a difficult time at anybody's age to suddenly go from what is ostensibly a career to being shelved.
I don't really feel I was being shelved. I did two tours at GCHQ in Cheltenham. My last tour was there for about 3.5 years, so I was really essentially a civilian anyway. I hadn't worn uniform for 3 years. And I bought houses and sold houses and developed houses, so because I was just doing a civil service job from 8 to 4, so I had a lot of spare time, and I had no money, because I got divorced, so, no, I wasn't really under the military umbrella at all.
So when you reached age 40 and you retired from military service, what was the next step for you, and how did you find that next step?
Because I was in Gloucester, I was buying up old Cotswold stone cottages and doing them up, selling them on to try and get some money.
And that was quite an advanced step, because in those days, anybody in the military was sort of encouraged to live on the forces base, and you were actively discouraged from buying property at that stage. Was that the same in the army? I know from experience from my father in the RAF, they didn't really like you buying property off camp.
I remember one chap being told he was getting above his station. I was told I was getting above my station when I opened a bank account in 1967. Private soldiers don't have bank accounts, that's for officers. No, I was told that the private soldiers didn't have bank accounts, it was only for officers.
So you were taking steps to, fairly honest, before you left the army. And when you left the army, you spent a year as the thatcher. How the hell did you get involved in thatching roofs? And are they prevalent in Gloucestershire? I mean, Devon and Cornwall, yes, but...
No, there's not a lot. I'd had enough of intelligence work. There's a lot of stress in it, although you don't realise it at the time. And so I've been doing a lot of manual work, restoring houses, and I saw an advertisement to take a franchise as a thatcher. And I knew I had my severance pay coming, so I thought, well, I've been 25 years in the army, it's about time I started investing in myself. So I decided to use my severance pay to buy a franchise. So I did that. I did 6 months training. We had a barn in Wokingham where we could practice, but most of the job was done on the job. Most of the training was done on the job. If we had a particularly difficult window or gable or something, we would go to the centre and practice on that before we did that. So I did that for about a year, and then I thought, yeah, I mean, the money was very good, and there was plenty of work in hand. I was down in Hampshire by now, and I was touching a roof, and a customs officer came and called me off the roof and said, I want to check your vehicle for diesel, for red diesel. So we got that, and I got talking to him, and the next thing I know, I took the civil service open exam. I went in as a customs officer, as a two-ringer.
Two-ringer?
Yeah, well, it's executive officer, but you start with one ring, you go up to two rings, so...
Time for your third piece of music, Ron, and what did you choose this time?
It was Barry Manilow, Could It Be Magic? I've always liked piano. I studied music at school before I left. And it starts off as Chopin, then it builds up, and it finishes with almost a Phil Spector wall of sound at the end. And it's just something that is nice. And then it tails off back to a solo piano piece again.
Baby, I love you.
stories.
Ron Potter, former military man, Thatcher, teacher and now businessman here in Spain, is my guest, sharing his life story. Ron, we talked obviously about your life in the army and how you found yourself back in the civil service. You mentioned in the first part that you were brought up in Dartford, mm-hmm. in Kent. Dartford Grammar School, of course, which is the home or the alma mater of Mick Jagger. Were you there at the same time?
No, he left the year I joined. He was in the same year as my brother-in-law, in fact.
Was this a hotbed of creative output, Dartford Grammar, in those days, or was this just...
I don't think so. Mick Jagger was known as being a very good cricketer and good basketball player, and not particularly as his music.
And was everybody encouraged to follow in his footsteps or not?
The opposite, no. It was very much... If you remember Mick Jagger in the 60s, they were very much the
bad boys of
bad
rock.
Bad boys, yeah, the bête noire of rock.
And you weren't influenced by him when in your early days of the army?
No, I went to see the Stones in the YMCA in Dartford, but no, the Stones and the Beatles, they were just there, you know, as a lot of other groups were in those in the 60s.
Yeah.
An exciting time.
Except
when you're a soldier,
exactly.
with a short back and sides.
Yes. Did you ever, I mean, it's interesting, actually, in that period of time when you had so many changing styles, the long hair and the clothes, to actually come back and be so easily identifiable as a military person. Was that difficult when you came back to the UK, having been abroad?
No, not at all. We would come back and we'd go straight into London and go into the markets there, because you could drink 24 hours a day. And there was a lot of respect for the forces. You'd hitchhike around and you'd always get a lift. And it wasn't really until 69, 70 when the IRA started and they started kidnapping soldiers and that the whole thing changed. And then people didn't tend to respect the army anymore for some reason. It's probably because of national service when people had done it before.
Yeah.
They'd all done a stint.
And you did a tour of duty in Northern Ireland, didn't you?
Yeah.
In those days, obviously, you were allowed to grow your hair, so you weren't so easily identifiable. Where were you, in Lisbon or...?
Oh, I was in Armagh.
Oh, you were in Armagh.
Mm.
And what was that like, being over there?
It's just a strange experience, really, because it's not like being a soldier in a soldier's... a soldier's world. You know, you can't shoot the enemy and you can't do this, that and the other, and there's no section attacks or artillery. You can't fire artillery across Armagh, unfortunately.
A lot of military people who've been stationed in Northern Ireland, one of the overriding feelings they had was it was actually a really boring posting. Was it boring?
All the military service is boring. Yeah, 90% or 95% boredom and 5% of fear and chaos.
Great life.
Well, I was in the intelligence, remember, so I told everyone else to go and and do things.
What brought you here to Spain?
An advert in the Times. As I said, I was buying and selling houses. I just sold a house. I had some money. And I saw an advert in the Times, buy a piece of paradise. So I came down and bought three pieces of paradise.
And that was it, because didn't you go to Asturias, first of all? Where did Asturias fit in?
No, I came down here about 97, 98, I think. And I bought three ruins and renovated two of them, put them together. And then I was still teaching in England, and my wife she was there on a course. And obviously we met, she was from Asturias. And I went to visit her a few times in Asturias. And then she contracted cancer. So I said, do you want me to come down and help? So she said, yes. So I came down here and never went back.
And were you married to Carmen then? Or?
No. We were barely boyfriend and girlfriend. We'd been seeing each other for 6 months, but, you know, from a distance. And, yeah, I came down October 2010. And never went back.
And Carmen was presumably from this part of the world, was she? Or was she?
She's from Asturias.
She's from Asturias.
Yeah, you couldn't be further apart. I mean, she actually lives on the Bay of Biscay.
Yeah. So you came down here to a part of Spain that in those days was pretty unknown to many British people. And what attracted you to it? Was it just the peace and quiet, the opportunity of the property?
Both, yeah. But I was working then, teaching one-to-one, which is not stressful, but, you know, I'd had the life of stress, but it was just nice to come away. This, staggered across it, you know, purely by luck. And I loved it. I would come down here, take a fortnight off, drive down, spend 10 days doing very little, and then go back again. And there was also the investment as well. You know, I realised, because I was doing it in UK, I realised, well, I can probably double my money here in a very short time. So it was half and half.
I mean, were you still dealing with property in the UK at the time, or not so much?
No, I wasn't. Well, yes, I was up until I came over here. Until I started investing down here.
Ron, what's your fourth piece of music, and why this one?
I've always liked the Stones. In fact, I've grown to like them more. I was more a Beatles fan in the 60s, but now I tend to like the Stones more. And again, I was talking earlier on about trad jazz. It's when everyone plays their own, or they appear to be playing their own little thing, but it all gels together. And this is a marvellous example of that, I think. Plenty of guitar, plenty of electric guitar, and Mr. Jagger strutting his stuff. But mainly, I like the interplay between Ronnie Woods and Keith Richards.
This is Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
Now, during the sales at El Corte Inglés, you've got a wide selection of swimwear items for only 12 euros.
Those are the sales at El Corte Inglés.
TRE. Life Stories. With Ian Rutter.
I'm Ian Rutter, and today I'm in the peaceful village of Melahis in the Valle de la Crin, a hidden corner of Andalusia between Granada and the Costa Tropical, a valley filled with orange, almond and olive trees. And this particular village is home to my guest today, Ron Potter, sharing his life story. You live here, Ron, with your wife, Carmen, and your daughter. How did you find adjusting to life here? So you bought your first three properties. What was it that then made you decide that this was a place that you could call home and where you could start a business and make a living?
Well, the reason I came to Spain is because the sick Carmen had cancer. So after she finished her chemotherapy and radiotherapy, she took 3 months to convalesce, and we came down here. And she's a doctor. She was working in pharmaceutical companies in sales and marketing and medical management. And while we were down here, just by pure chance, we managed to pick up a lovely piece of land for pennies. And Carmen decided to build a house there. And we were there, by then, in Madrid. And she decided that she didn't want to be in Madrid in that life. So we built the house down here, and we saw the opportunity, we found the opportunity that there was a business going for sale, so we bought it. It was as simple as that.
And this was something you'd never done before? I mean, okay, you dealt in property, but you hadn't run an estate agency in Spain before.
No.
Carmen, coming from a sort of medical pharmaceutical background, obviously had no real experience of estate agency either.
Yeah, but that doesn't occur to most soldiers. You can't turn around your sergeant major and say, "Oh, well, I don't think I can do that, sir." Just tell you what to do and you get on with it.
I mean, was it a thriving going concern at the time, or was it just a cheap business?
No, it was thriving. Our intention was to build it up, which we did. We increased it almost tenfold in the first 4 years, and then factors conspired. So we still got the business, but there's not the call for it now, and everything changes, it always does. Now everything's got booking.com and this sort of, you know, really hyper Airbnb are taking over everything, so you can't compete against those. But we still have a niche market, we have a lot of repeat clients, but it's not as it was. No, it'll come back, I'm sure.
And you now have a daughter,
mm-hmm.
who is adopted.
That's right, yeah. Carmen and I tried for a child unsuccessfully, and we'd spend a lot of time in Morocco, because from here you can literally commute. You can be down in Tangiers in 3 hours, you know, it's no problem at all. And we spent a lot of time in Morocco, and my mother died, left me some money, and I thought, well, I don't want to blow it on anything. So we decided to put it to good use, so we adopted Aya and invested the money for education, and never regretted it since.
And was that a straightforward process, or was it a very bureaucratic nightmare?
Oh, it was 9 months in Spain alone, having all sorts of interviews and psychiatric evaluations before they'd even let us consider adopting in Spain. Then we went through the whole rigmarole in Morocco, which lasted for another year or so. It was about 2.5 years by the time we actually got back, brought Bayer back with us. So no, it wasn't. And I'm still now trying to get British citizenship for Aya, although I don't know if it'll be worth much these days.
Is that important to you, that she has British citizenship?
It was quite important 3 or 4 years ago when we started the process. That's how long it's taken. You know, it would have been worthwhile. But now, with us withdrawn from the European community, and I don't know. Nobody knows. You know, we don't know what value, what worth a British passport will have. Sorry to say that, but you know, it's a fact of life, I think.
It's still an unknown quantity.
Exactly.
We have no idea what the outcome is going to be.
I mean, the way I understand the rules at the moment is that she can have dual nationality till she's 18, and then she has to make a choice. So we've got 10 years leeway to see what goes on.
Ron, your fifth piece of music, and what is it?
Oh, yeah, this is the military anthem, to all intents and purposes. I mean, it's a lovely piece of music anyway, but it was adopted by the military, in particular Paris. There was a series by Linda LaPlante called Civis, which talked about paratroopers leaving the army and the problems they had assimilated. And this featured quite a lot in there. And it's just a lovely song.
And what's it called?
Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
Destruction, baptisms of fire. I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached high, and in the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers in arms. So many
Ron Potter, formerly of the British Army, a thatcher, teacher, and owner of several businesses in the Lecrin Valley between Granada and the coast. Ron is my guest today on Live Stories. Now, Ron, you have mentioned to me fairly recently that retirement is something that you are contemplating. You've obviously had a couple of retirements already in your life, so for the army, various changes of career. I mean, is retirement a real possibility, or do you think you will just go on working?
I can't imagine myself retired. There's lots of things I want to do. I'd like to write. I do write now. I've got a website, ronpotter.org, and I like telling ditties. I think that was something that you learn on board ship when there's nothing else to do. You all tell funny little stories. But no, I'll always have to do something. My wife is the same. We'll do something, whether it will be continue this business or I don't know. I really don't know.
And you mentioned writing. Mm-hmm. Do you feel you have a book in you? Do you think that is something you would like to do?
I wrote a book already about the adoption process with Aya. Casablanca de Casa Nuestra, Moroccan adoption. Not using my own name, I must admit. But, I've got plenty of stories. I've got plenty of background as well. I can make some books.
You have had a fairly successful, or you have built a fairly successful career here in Spain. I mean, we're sitting in your gardens in Melahisa, and this is a beautiful house. So things have gone reasonably well for you since you've been here. Do you think this, Spain particularly, is a land of opportunity for people like you and other people who have the drive and vision to create something?
Yeah, yes, there are untold people who have come down here and done very well indeed. The general vision of Spain is the Costas, where everyone comes down, drinks Watney's Red Barrel and gets drunk. But, if you want to work, you can. You can use whatever skills you have.
So, working is something that you enjoy doing. Would you get bored by retirement?
I probably would, yeah. I probably would.
Do you have any challenges that you still want to face? Or are you getting to that time in your life where you actually think, I'm quite comfortable here, and provided I can do a few of the things on my wish list, I'm not really looking for a new adventure?
No, I think I lived the first half of my life until I was 40. I mean, people come up to me and say, Ron, do you fancy? And I say, yes. And they say, well, I haven't said what it is yet. Don't matter, let's do it. So I was diving, I did parachuting, I did just about everything that was going. Because it was there. I don't think there's anything I'm missing in life. I don't know. And maybe if somebody says something that catches my interest.
How do you feel? I mean, do you feel Spanish? Do you feel British? Do you feel European? Where do you feel you fit?
It sounds corny, but, a citizen of the world. All right, I'm in Europe at the moment, but I've lived in Cyprus on and off for 10 years. I lived in Germany for a year. I lived in Malta for 3 years. Probably European. Spanish, I was thinking that today, because having been here now for 15 years, the language is not a problem, and I can just talk to anyone in the street. I definitely feel Spanish at times.
And do you feel any strong affinity to the UK anymore, or is that weakening post-Brexit referendum?
No, it definitely weakens the further you're away, because and the worse you tend to be treated as well. Now they're talking about freezing pensions, they're talking about all sorts of nonsense. Freezing of pensions will obviously affect me, but for people who've decided to come and live abroad, I think it's to suddenly kick their feet out from underneath them is not really on. I'm lucky, I'm married to a Spaniard, so I'm covered by the Spanish health systems and Social Security and all the rest of it, although I've paid into that. If somebody decides they want to retire, it may be for their health, it may just be because they can't afford to live in England. I think then to take everything away from them, make them back to England, and put more pressure on Social Security, put more pressure on the National Health Service, is just ridiculous.
Do you think it'll come to that?
I sincerely hope not. I mean, you're talking about a matter of pennies. I mean, my pension increased by 1%. £6. It's ridiculous.
And your future presumably will be here.
Yeah, for the foreseeable future. I mean, Aya's doing very well at school. I would never say my future. You know, I would never predict the future. Wish I could.
Exactly. If anyone wants to know more about the businesses you run here, Ron, how can they find out more information?
Well, the sales is Lacrim Valley Property, which is quite simple. The rest of the businesses comes under the heading of Via Sewer, which does the property maintenance and rentals. We have hundreds of houses for rent all over the area. And the language school is El Valle Inglés. That's in English, El Valle Inglés .s. Yeah, so look on there. It's very easy to find.
And before we say goodbye, Ron, what's your last piece of music and why have you chosen this one?
Oh, it's just a lovely song. I mean, I've listened to this for probably 40 years. It gets more poignant the older you get because it sounds as if you're talking about dying, you know. But it's just a lovely song, and it's John Denver. He's got a lovely voice and plays some lovely music. And this one particularly appeals to me. I mean, weep a bit now and again, but there you go.
Oh, you big softy. Ron Potter, thank you so much for being my guest and for sharing your life story. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian.
Days they pass so quickly now, nights are seldom long. Time around me whispers when it's cold. Changes somehow frighten me, still I have to smile. It turns me on to think of growing old. For though my life's been good to me, there's still so much to do, so many things my mind has never known. I'd like to raise a family, I'd like to sail away and dance across the mountains on the moon. I have to say it now, it's been a good life all in all. It's really fine to have the chance to hang around and lie there by the fire and watch the evening tire while all my friends and my old lady sit and pass a pipe around and talk of poems and prayers and promises and things that we believe in. How sweet it is to love someone, how right it is to care. How long it's been since yesterday, what about tomorrow? What about our dreams and all the memories we share?
Life Stories.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.
Once upon a time, there was a little boy who saw an emperor walking past his house.
He's got no clothes on.
Did you ever wonder what happened to that little boy?
Well, I grew up to be Mr. Grumpy.
Everywhere I go, I'm being tracked all over the internet.
I expose modern life.
I go to one of the airlines, I look through the prices and let's say it's €1,000. Then I go to another airline and that's €1,500. So I then go back to the other one, but now that one's €1,100.
In my own way.
I download the Tor browser.
Oh my goodness.
So that don't know when I want to go to Gatwick.
Join me, Mr. Grumpy and Bill Padley on Let's Talk every other Friday.
It's extreme, but
it's getting
on my
nerves. TRE, Talk Radio Europe.
On the hour, news that matters to you.
TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
A news centre at 1, the family of...